talking about the talking cure.
We all have stories about our lives. So I was a writer before I became a therapist, and I feel like part of my job as a therapist is to do what I did as a writer, which is to edit. So when people come in, I'm almost editing their stories, because people come in with these stories: I'm unlovable, nothing good will ever happen for me, and, you know, this always happens, this never will happen, something's wrong with me, right? And so people come in with these faulty narratives that are historical narratives, they're stories that they're carrying from their past, but they don't fit anymore. These stories are, you know, they need an edit. They need to be revised.
That's Lori Gottlieb. We talk with her about her best-selling memoir, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Then a novel about a therapist who finds herself crossing dangerous lines with a patient while struggling with her own grief.
So the book opens and we learn very quickly that her son, Tom, who is 17, is missing. So she's a woman really in grief. Her son is missing and she doesn't know where he is. And she goes down to the waiting room to collect a new client. And as she's walking down the corridor and she looks up and sees him, she sees somebody who looks very shockingly like her son, Tom. And for a sort of beautiful and terrible moment, she thinks it's him. And obviously it's not, as she gets closer. But in that moment, really things start to unravel for her.
That's Bev Thomas. Her debut novel, A Good Enough Mother, was a breakout sensation when it was released in the UK. It came out on this side of the pond April 30th. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. Have you ever wondered what goes on in the mind of your therapist while she or he is helping you figure out what's going on in yours? Well, New York Times bestselling author, psychotherapist, and national advice columnist Lori Gottlieb has written a new memoir that illuminates that and more. Maybe You Should Talk to Someone is a funny and thought-provoking look behind the scenes of a therapist's world, from both sides of the couch. One day, Gottlieb is a therapist helping patients in her Los Angeles practice. The next, her own world comes crashing down when her longtime boyfriend announces he's leaving. Enter Wendell, the quirky but seasoned therapist in whose office she suddenly lands. As Gottlieb explores the inner chambers of her patients' lives, she finds that the questions they're struggling with are the very ones she's now bringing to her therapist. In Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, Gottlieb invites us into her world as both clinician and patient, examining the truths and fictions we tell ourselves and others. Lori Gottlieb writes The Atlantic Weekly's Dear Therapist advice column. She also writes regularly for the New York Times and has appeared on The Today Show, Good Morning America, CNN, and other media venues. She's the author and co-author of several other books. Lori Gottlieb, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This was a wonderful book for me in particular to read because I spent 10 years as a therapist, and I'd say that this is absolutely the best book I've ever read about doing therapy.
Well, that's quite a compliment, especially given your background.
What's so wonderful about it is that you really talk about it from both sides, from you as a therapist and you as a client. How did that come about?
Well, as you can imagine, I never, I didn't sit down one day and say, I'm going to write a book about my own experience in therapy. I never could have anticipated that I would do something like that. It came about because I was, and I write about this a little bit in the book, that I was supposed to be writing a book about happiness, and I was actually miserable, and writing that book was making me miserable. And through, you know, I was starting off as a therapist at that time, and you can't really go through your training and not want to get it something very deep and very real. And I think that the book that I was trying to write was just scratching the surface of what I was seeing in the therapy room. And I wanted to bring the therapy room to readers because I feel like we don't talk about those things enough and we don't talk about them in a real way enough. And so I thought about just bringing my therapy room where I'm the therapist to readers. But then I thought that was somewhat disingenuous because, you know, we are people too. And I wanted people to see that we're more the same than we are different. And so I ended up wanting to show how I landed in therapy after a crisis and what that evolution was like and how it was very similar to what my patients were going through.
Yes, and it's interesting that you just said you started out with really what was the more fundamental crisis, which was around writing this book, but that's not what got you into therapy.
Right, right. And I think so often people come to therapy with one thing, and they end up realizing that the issue is something deeper. And I don't say that to scare people, because I think that people have this idea that you go to therapy and you never leave. And it's very much not like that. In fact, our goal from day one is to get you to leave. We want you to feel better. We want you to feel better as quickly as possible, and we want the change to be lasting, so that you don't need us. So I think that so often people will come in and they'll say, you know, this just happened with my relationship, or this just happened with my parent, or this just happened with my sibling or my boss. And really, there's some pattern that's going on that they're not aware of. And if they can just understand more about that pattern, they can make different choices in their lives, and they won't have so much trouble.
You start the book out with, I'd say, probably one of the toughest cases of the worried well. I mean, he's not really well. This isn't somebody who is, like, at risk for, you know, harming themselves or others. But, you know, it's garden variety therapy. Very tough case. Guy named John. Tell us about him and what was so difficult about this case.
John was a very self-absorbed Hollywood producer who had trouble seeing his own role in his suffering. And so he externalized everything. Everybody else was the problem. Everybody else was an idiot. He knew better. You know, what we might call narcissistic. And he was demeaning. He was insulting. He was rude to me. He fundamentally, you know, saw the world through a very distorted lens. And yet he was highly successful. But he was having trouble in his marriage, and he was having trouble sleeping, and he didn't realize that the source of his problem was something else. And I don't want to sort of spoil what it is, because mm-hmm. it was quite a shock to me. And I think that's part of what happens in therapy, is that people tell you stories, and they're only telling you a version of the story from their point of view, and they're not telling you everything. And so you have a very limited view until you really start to get to know them. And what came out later, I never would have seen coming.
Yeah. But, you know, he's tough because, as you call him a narcissist, and that's, you know, that's in kind of the category of personality disorders. Could you tell us a difference between personality disorders and mood disorders? And then I want to go back to the personality disorders.
Yeah, so personality disorders are what we call characterological disorders, meaning that in any environment, a person has a certain way of relating. So somebody with, say, borderline personality disorder will have an intense fear of abandonment. They will see the world in very black or white ways. They're quick to anger. They get hurt very easily and very quickly. You know, so that's something that's in their character, which can be changed, but it takes a lot of work. A mood disorder is something like you're going through a depression. Mood disorders are things that you know you have it and you don't want to have it. A personality disorder is something where you don't know that you have a problem. You think that everybody else is the problem.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And it kind of points to one of the difficulties about therapy and even working with people, say, with personality disorders, and that is that they don't tend to come into therapy. So what I want to ask you is, how do you work with people who don't think they have the problem?
Yeah, well, what happens is they might come into therapy, but it's because they want everyone else to change. Mm-hmm. So they're coming in because they want you to help them get somebody else in their life to change. My partner's doing this. Help me to get my partner to do it differently, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't want to change. They don't think that they have any role in what's going on. So that's sort of the issue. Or, you know, with narcissists, they generally, you know, there are certain kinds of personality disorders that you see less of in therapy. Borderline you see more of because they're in so much pain in their relationships, but they think that the other person is the problem.
Right, whereas narcissists don't tend to do that. You know, I want to ask you just quickly, now that we're on narcissism, there's a book that was published after Trump came into office that was an interesting collection of essays by various psychologists and psychiatrists who, you know, violated what's called the Goldwater Rule, that you're not supposed to diagnose somebody that you haven't actually interviewed. Mm-hmm. And they diagnosed him as a malignant narcissist. I'd say people, you know, in the field would probably nod their heads at that. Talk about the issue of diagnosis, and do you think you can make a diagnosis like that in a book like that?
Yeah, so in Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, I do talk about diagnosis and its limitations. And one of the things I say is that diagnosis can be helpful in that it helps you understand, you know, generally what this person might be experiencing, and also in terms of treatment plan, how you might be able to help them, what's most effective in that situation. But when I'm sitting across from somebody, I'm not looking at, say, John as, oh, there's the narcissist. He's John, who happens to be sometimes kind of an asshole, right? Mm-hmm. But there's more to him than that. And so I don't want to lose the person in the diagnosis. If I only looked at John as a narcissist, I would lose every other thing about him that made me like him, that made me find his vulnerabilities, his tender spots, his humanity. And so I'm very wary of diagnosis in that way. I use it in the back of my mind. It's there because it helps me. But when I'm sitting in a room with someone, you know, I'm interacting with them as a human being, and I don't want to trap somebody with a label because they think that then I will miss things and our relationship will suffer.
Yeah, it's maybe a little bit like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. You know, once you kind of slap a label on somebody, then you're only going to be seeing certain things.
Yes.
Now, people often come into therapy wanting to be told what to do. They're in pain. They don't know what to do. That's why they're there. But that's not really the therapist's job, is it?
It's not. And it's not because we're withholding information, right? It's not, you know, part of it is that people assume that we have the quote unquote right answer. And, you know, as my therapist said to me one day, he said, you know, I only know what I would do. I don't know what you should do. And of course, then I said, okay, well, then just tell me, what would you do? You know, I completely missed his meaning in the moment, but later I realized what he was saying, which was, you need to learn to trust yourself. You need to learn to figure out what to do, because you're the one who gets to choose what you want to do with your life. And the more you can understand yourself, the better the decisions will be. So the goal of a therapist is not to make decisions, just like with our kids, right? We don't want to make all their decisions for them. We want them to develop a sense of trust in themselves. We want them to develop a sense of good judgment. And that's what we help them to do so that they won't need us. And the other part of it is, you know, there's this word that I love that I actually have posted up in my office, ultra-crepidarianism, which is basically giving advice outside of your knowledge. And you know, I might be seeing a couple, for example, and I might be thinking, oh man, they should really get divorced, right? but maybe for them, maybe I wouldn't want to be in that marriage, but maybe for them, it is the better thing for them, right? You know, and also, you know, people come all the time with these big life decisions, like, should I have another baby? I don't know if you should have another baby. You know, I know how I would make that decision, but I can't make that decision for you.
So what are some of the things you do to help them to make those kinds of decisions?
Well, first of all, I help them to see that there's, you know, I think a lot of times in life we imagine that there's one perfect solution to whatever issue that we're bringing in. And, you know, in the case of, you know, should I have another baby? Well, it completely depends on the person's situation. And also, if they have another baby, their life will look a certain way. And if they don't have another baby, their life will look another way, both of which they can and can't predict in advance. So there are going to be pros and cons to either situation. And at the end of the day, they have to decide, you know, what are they willing to live with? What are they willing not to live with? And, you know, either way, there's going to be loss. And I think sometimes people don't want to make decisions because when you make one decision, you lose the other decision. You lose what you would have had with the other decision. And so people want to have their cake and eat it too, and they want to kind of have both. You can't have both. You have to choose. You have to make a choice between two things, and there will be some loss involved.
Yeah, and Lori Gottlieb, in this book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, that's kind of what happens to you, actually to your boyfriend. At the beginning of the book, you're about to get married to somebody you've been with 2 years. You're a single parent in the sense that you know, he's not the father of your 7-year-old child. And all of a sudden he tells you that he doesn't want to live with children. So in a way, he's gone through some of that process you just spoke about.
Right. He had gone through that process, without giving me a heads up that he was going through that process. And so that was the shocking part of that revelation. And I think that, you know, again, I think that where I start out in the book is where, as our friends do, they support us, and they, you know, everybody thinks that he's just, you know, completely unethical and selfish and all of these things. And my therapist doesn't. And I can't imagine how my therapist doesn't think that. You know, I'm sure that the whole point of going to therapy was to get validation for my perspective of, you know, how could he do this, not just to me, but to my child. And my therapist really helps me to see it through a wider lens, which is, you know, I think that he probably didn't want to give up. You know, he was in love with me, and he didn't want to give that up. But on the other hand, he realized more and more as the reality of, you know, what would happen when we got married, you know, what it would be like for him, and his kids were older and he was about to become an empty nester. He had kids younger than I did. And, you know, I think that he was probably teetering on that tightrope between, I want to be with this woman, and I don't want to raise kids again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So tell us about your therapist. I mean, you went in there to be validated. You thought you were just coming in for some crisis management. How did you feel about your therapist and the therapy? Well, you've told us how you felt about the therapy at first, but how did you feel about your therapist at first?
I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of therapy, is that I think people don't realize how important that relationship is when they first come in. So, you know, there's even these studies, study after study, will show you that your relationship with your therapist is the most important factor in the success of your therapy, more than the therapist's training, what they specialize in, how many years they've been doing it. Not that those things don't matter, but that the relationship really is key to how much progress you're going to make. And that evolves over time. So when I first went to see Wendell, I thought he was a little bit, you know, kind of like straight out of Therapist Central casting, the cardigan, the khakis. he was a little bit quirky. But I was so concerned with myself and what this crisis and what I was going through that I didn't care that much about, you know, whether he was nerdy or not nerdy, or, you know, those things, those sort of snap judgments that we make about people. And then as I got to know him, I realized, you know, he taught me so much about being a therapist. He was much more he was much farther along than I was at that time, and he was so himself in the room. Not in terms of he was very boundaried, but he brought his personality into the room, and wasn't afraid to just be human in a way that I think, as a lot of therapists who are starting out, don't know that that's okay, and not only that it's okay, but that it's encouraged, and that you'll help people more the more human you can be in the room. So I would, you know, he would say or do something in the room with me that I found very effective, and I'd find myself almost like Cyrano, you know, I'd drive over to my office, and then I'd say something along those lines to somebody who I thought that it would be helpful for, and it would be really effective. And so while I was there for therapy, I think I also got a crash course in training as well.
Yeah, say more about that line between keeping boundaries that are important for protecting the client and being genuine and sharing things about yourself. What are the guidelines there?
Yeah, I think it's almost like if you're a pianist, you have to know your scales really well before you can improvise. You have to have the training and you have to have it down really well so that when you improvise, you can improvise really well. And I think the same thing is true of therapy, that you have to have the skills down very well before you have that freedom to kind of, go in a different direction. That you have to be very intentional about those choices. You can't just, it's not a free-for-all in there. And it wasn't that he was revealing things about himself in terms of talking about his life, but he would reveal his personality, and he was a real person in the room. And he would call me on things all the time. So there's this term, this Buddhist term, idiot compassion, which is what we often do with friends or family, which is, we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to upset them. And so we give them our compassion and our support. That doesn't help people in the therapy room. We want to be compassionate, but we want to hold up the mirror to them. And so what I think Wendell taught me was about sort of wise compassion, which is how can you hold up the mirror and help people see things they don't necessarily want to see about the ways that they're shooting themselves in the foot? How can you do that in a gentle way, but also by just being yourself, by being, not being like the brick wall therapist. Nobody wants to come in and talk to a brick wall. But on the other hand, not being the person who's just, overly supportive in this way that's not helping the patient.
Could you give us an example of how he did that with you?
I think when I came in and, I really wanted him to support my position that, what my boyfriend did was horrible, and he didn't support my position, and I think that was the best thing that could have happened, because I wouldn't have learned what I needed to learn about that situation and what my role was in it, and how there actually were these hints along the way that my boyfriend wasn't completely comfortable with the kid situation, even though he never said anything, that there were little moments that I picked up on that neither of us talked about, because I actually did the same thing my boyfriend did, which was I saw that there was something about this relationship that wasn't going to work, but I didn't want to bring it up because I didn't want to not be with him. And I think he did the exact same thing until push came to shove and he had to tell me. And so we both, went through that relationship with an avoidance of something huge, because we didn't want to face it. And I never would have seen it in the same way if my therapist had, had sort of validated my perspective on who this person was. He's not a bad guy. Did he handle it well? No. But did I handle it well? Not really.
Yeah, and as you said in the beginning, he actually helped you figure out what was a much deeper issue. It had nothing to do with him. You say in the book, Lori Gottlieb, and maybe you should talk to someone, that therapy works best when people start getting better. So tell us, and you have kind of a model of the stages of change. Could you tell us how that worked with you at coming to your own understanding of what the deeper issues were?
Right.
Were the stages?
There's this paradox of therapy, which is that when people come in, they're generally, you know, something is going on that made them that day, that week, that month make that call to the therapist. And so they're coming in with often something specific. Sometimes there's a general feeling of stuckness, or, you know, they don't really know what the problem is, but something feels off or not right. But generally people will come in because something has happened, something is happening, and they need someone to talk to about it. And I think that what happens is people want to deal with that issue at first. And once they start feeling better, they're less depressed, they're less anxious, their relationship is going more smoothly, whatever it is, that's when the real work begins. And they don't know that. They think, you know, sometimes people think, oh, I'm done, good, I'm feeling better. But if they go out into the world then, they might just repeat the same pattern in another context, and then they'll be right back in our office. And we don't want that to happen. We want them to understand what got them in the situation in the first place. So we don't just want to solve that problem for them, but we want them to understand how they got in the pickle, and then we want them to not get in that pickle again. So once they start feeling better, they're stronger and they're more able to hear things that maybe they weren't able to hear when they're in crisis.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting how all this develops. You know, there are so many things that in reality are true that we think is the, so many of the things that are true are the opposite of what we think they might be. You know, at one point in the book, for example, you say that we have a choice between believing one of two things, both of which we have evidence for. I'm lovable, I'm unlovable. And often we choose the one that makes us feel bad. Why is that?
We all have stories about our lives. So I was a writer before I became a therapist, and I feel like part of my job as a therapist is to do what I did as a writer, which is to edit. So when people come in, I'm almost editing their stories, because people come in with these stories: I'm unlovable, nothing good will ever happen for me. You know, whatever their story is. And, you know, this always happens. This never will happen. Something's wrong with me, right? And so people come in with these faulty narratives that are historical narratives, they're stories that they're carrying from their past, but they don't fit anymore. These stories they need an edit. They need to be revised. And so I help people to revise their stories, because when people come in, I'm listening not just to their story, but to their flexibility with the story. Can they see that maybe there's something about the story that needs, that they're telling it from a very specific perspective. But what if the other characters in the story could tell their version of the story? How would the story be different? Who are the major characters and who are the minor characters? And is the protagonist moving forward, or is the protagonist going in circles? And usually it's the latter. So we really work with the stories the voices in their heads, which is the story that pulls the strings of every choice they make. And then they wonder, well, why am I in this situation again? Why did this happen to me again? It must be because I'm unlovable, I'm worthless, I'm whatever their story is. But no, it's because something's wrong with your story. And when you change your story, you're not going to get into those situations again, because the plot will change too. When you change your narrative, the plot will change.
So it's very much around the issue of choice. You know, I love that you, that Lori Gottlieb in this book, maybe you should talk to someone, that you give the example of Viktor Frankl and his book, Man's Search for Meaning, one of my very favorite books. He was a survivor of Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And he really talks about how we have a choice. You can either choose to respond to whatever circumstances you're in the way that is the best and most nourishing and positive for you, or you can choose to be overwhelmed by them. I mean, something in that says, well, it can't be that simple, because people have to have the skills to do that. But something at the core of that is very true.
It is, and I think we don't have a choice in the sense of if you're very depressed, you can't just choose not to be depressed, for example, right? So, but I think that when we look at our external circumstances, we have a choice in terms of how we respond to them. So if your, you know, partner does X or your mother does Y, there might, you know, the world is surrounded by difficult people, right? There's difficult people all over. But sometimes we are the cause of our own difficulties because we make a choice that's going to make things harder for us in terms of how we respond to a difficult external circumstance. And so if we make different choices in our response, we will see different things happen. And I think that people feel like, well, I don't have any control over this because so-and-so is doing X to me. Well, so-and-so might be doing that, but how you respond is going to be very important in what happens after so-and-so does X to you.
Yeah, and you give the example of someone who comes to you who has a terminal cancer diagnosis.
Yes.
And I think that, tell us how that illustrates what we've just been talking about.
Right. You know, I think her story is so important because it's not, I think there are sort of two narratives around, you know, what happens when you have a terminal illness, which is either you drown in despair or you become this, you know, optimistic role model. and she's neither. And I think that that's really important for people to see is that she's, you know, dealing with these really nightmarish choices that she has to make. You know, she's young, she's in her 30s, she just got married, and she discovers on her honeymoon something in her breast, and it ends up that she thought maybe she was pregnant, which they wanted to happen, and she ends up, you know, having cancer, and at first it seems like it's very treatable, and then something else happens, and she gets this, you know, terminal diagnosis, and it's devastating. And she has to deal with the fact that, you know, she's going to die at this very young age and they don't know how long it's going to be, but they know it'll be, you know, maybe a year, maybe five, maybe 10. And there's a huge difference between 1 and 10, right? Mm-hmm. And there are all these choices that have to happen along the way and how she deals with it. And she's not, you know, she's not some zen, you know, you know, example of you know how to be calm during this. She rages at the world. She has all the normal reactions, but she does reflect upon her choices and ends up having, you know, the kind of experience that in a horrific circumstance that is the best of circumstances you can have, which is she got to choose how she was going to die. She got to choose the whole process and how she wanted to live before she died. And I think a lot of us without a terminal diagnosis hanging over our heads, we aren't that conscious about our choices. You know, we think, oh, I'll think about that later, or I'll do that later. But she really got to reflect and say, how do I want to live my life? How do I want to live today? And I think more of us could use some of that reflection. How do I want to choose how I'm going to live today? You know, given all the stuff that's going to happen, that's going to be frustrating and irritating and difficult, how do I want to live today?
And that is such an important and inspiring message. Lori Gottlieb, this is just a terrific book. It was a total page-turner. I read it, I think, in two sessions. I couldn't read it all the way through. It was absolutely fantastic. Maybe you should talk to someone, a therapist, her therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Lori Gottlieb. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from her book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Next up, a novel about a therapist and about how her work and her personal life collide. Stay tuned after the break. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I invite you to sign up for the Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about therapy and therapists. Earlier, we spoke with Lori Gottlieb about her memoir, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Now, we explore some of the same terrain via fiction. Bev Thomas's debut novel, A Good Enough Mother, is a riveting page-turner that lets us inside the secret world of therapist and patient, this time where boundaries get crossed and events spiral out of control. Her protagonist, Ruth Hartland, is a psychotherapist with years of experience, but professional skill is no guard against private grief. The mother of grown twins, she's haunted by the fact that her difficult, fragile son, Tom, disappeared a year and a half earlier. She can't stop hoping she'll find him, but is living a kind of half-life waiting for him to return. Enter a new patient, Dan, who looks exactly like her missing son. She's determined to help him, but soon her own complicated feelings about how she failed her own boy cloud her professional judgment. And therein lies a tale of boundaries crossed, leading to new losses and, ultimately, new hope. A Good Enough Mother is a brilliant and beautiful story of mothering and how to let go of the ones we love when we must. Bev Thomas was a clinical psychologist in the UK's National Health Service for many years. She now works as a consultant in mental health and is working on her second novel. Bev Thomas, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me. Lovely to be here.
This book, A Good Enough Mother, the protagonist of the book is Ruth Hartland. She's a therapist in a practice in Britain's National Health Service. And the practice deals with trauma. Now, you were a clinical psychologist also for the NHS, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So I worked in primary care services. So I didn't myself work directly in trauma services. We were often the sort of portal that would refer on to other services. So we got to know them quite well through that. And so I was a clinical psychologist, as you say, and my protagonist, Ruth Hartland, in the book is a psychotherapist.
Tell us more about Ruth. Her 17-year-old son has been missing for a while when the book opens. So tell us about her and her relationship with her son and also her daughter, Carolyn, who is Tom's twin.
Exactly. So the book opens and we learn very quickly that her son, Tom, who is 17, is missing. He's one of a twin. And what we learn quite soon is that they're very different characters. So Tom has struggled in some ways and Carolyn is kind of perceived to be the sort of sibling that kind of gets it. It's very sociable and life ostensibly goes very well for her. And Tom, that's not the case. So we open with Ruth. So she's a woman really in grief. Her son is missing and she doesn't know where he is. And she goes down to the waiting room to collect a new client. And as she's walking down the corridor and she looks up and sees him, she sees somebody who looks very shockingly like her son, Tom. And for a sort of beautiful and terrible moment, she thinks it's him. And obviously it's not as she gets closer. But in that moment, really things start to unravel for her.
Yes, unravel. Now, in some ways, they've been unraveling for a long time. The dysfunction goes fairly far back. She has her own demons, and we should say she has a husband as well, although the marriage is they're separated at the point in which we're opening in the book. She has an alcoholic mother. So talk about Ruth and some of the demons that she's been dealing with.
Yeah, so we learn little snippets about her earlier life. And so she, I don't think it's made very explicit how old she was, but she was a child when her father left. So she was with her mother who had alcohol problems. And the idea is sort of sown really that she became a sort of carer as a child for her mother when she was drinking. So I guess I wanted to paint a picture of somebody who was a kind of really missed out on a sort of childhood and adolescence, really, because she was looking after her mother who had difficulties. And I guess, you know, that compulsion or that kind of familiarity with caring and looking after may well have been the thing that led her to going into train as a therapist. And certainly, you know, in my experience of seeing other people who work in the field, that can be an incredibly fantastic thing. It can make people be very good clinicians if they've had their own complicated experiences. She would have had her own therapy. She's a supervisor. But the decision she makes, which is a sort of crossing a very small invisible line in some ways at the beginning, is to not realize. I mean, she realizes that she would be bringing too much of her own stuff in some ways into the session, but her compulsion to see this new client, Dan Griffin, is to the extent that she wants to continue to see him, because I guess she wants to see somebody who reminds her of her son. But also I think she's kind of, you know, because she hasn't really been able to save or help her own son, I guess she sees it as an opportunity to sort of try and do that with somebody else.
So, and there's a lot to unpack there, really. I mean, you have this character who is very finely drawn, but also, as a former therapist myself, someone who I could easily recognize exactly this whole issue of why do people go into therapy and what are some of the minefields that people have to the therapists have to negotiate in dealing with their own former traumas or even ongoing traumas and their practice.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, you will know from your own experience too that, you know, people who work in that field, they're not immune from the difficulties of life, broken relationships, ill relatives, bereavement, sadness. You know, I mean, I think it's the stuff of life, isn't it? So I was kind of interested in exploring that through somebody in a way who kind of spends their working life helping other people to sort of excavate their demons in a way. And I guess, you know, although she has had struggles and we see that those struggles, my sense, I wanted to kind of open really with the idea that she was really functioning kind of well. She was compartmentalizing her life. And I do think lots of people do that, not just therapists. I think lots of people manage that. You know, you sometimes could be sitting on the train going into work, couldn't you, and think, you know, or you go into the office and you think, you know, you have no idea what goes on in people's sort of personal lives, good and bad, you know, and that somehow that kind of demarcation between private life and public life can help, can't it? Can enable people to sort of continue and manage. Because sometimes I think, you know, if you enabled it all to spill out, you wouldn't be able to kind of get up in the morning. But I was sort of interested in exploring that in a way that, what does that mean for her when a kind of catalyst comes along, when there's a kind of trigger that sort of tips her over?
Yeah, and that's a good feed into your title, A Good Enough Mother, because she is doing a good enough job, certainly. Tell us the origin of the title, of that term, The Good Enough Mother. It refers to a theory of the therapist Donald Winnicott.
Yeah, so he, I mean, it was very innovative at the time, and I personally think it's still really innovative and worth kind of really remembering and reflecting on. Because I guess what he was saying is that it really isn't about being the perfect person that goes to and solves and fixes all the time. That, you know, actually what he was absolutely advocating was, in a way, a form of imperfection. What he was saying was that as your child grows up, it's really important that they experience the imperfections of life. So managing frustrations, things not happening in the way that they might want them to, in some ways is a kind of, it's a really good internal learning of what life is about. And if they can internalize that through their mothering, then it is about equipping them as they go forth as adolescents or into the adult world. Life isn't always perfect. So I guess he was trying to say, you know, that striving for perfection is a bit of a nonsense, really. And it sort of can leave people ill-equipped in some ways, not just the parents, but the children themselves. And I guess, you know, in Ruth Hartland, in my book, although she tries desperately to do something different to her experience, she, in the end, ends up overdoing it with one of her children, in the sense that she's, you know, he struggles and he's having some difficulties, and rather than being able to bear the fact that he's struggling, she kind of wants to be in denial about it. She wants him to be somebody he's not. And I think that's, you know, it's very painful for parents to bear their unhappiness of their children, but I guess that's sort of what Donald Winnicott was also advocating, is that that's part of life, that is part of parenting.
Yeah, and she tries to be the perfect mother in some way. Not the good enough mother. She's very enmeshed with her son, which is something that actually is damaging to him.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are some key moments in the the book where I think that she's unable to separate from him in the way that she has separated more effectively with her daughter Carolyn. So in some ways, the more she sees him struggle, the more she gets over involved. And in a way, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, of course, what she really needs to be doing is stepping back and kind of just bearing whatever he's going through. But as it is, she, as you say, she gets kind of over involved, and it doesn't really work well for either of them.
And what's so interesting is that this is such a contrast to what she has to do in trauma therapy. Because in trauma therapy, you know, as you point out, she talks about it going into the lake with the patient. She has to help the patient stay with the feelings, to face the trauma, to talk about the trauma, which is so opposite from A, the way she grew up, and B, how she relates with her own family.
Yes, exactly. So she's very aware of what is required and what's the sort of useful thing to do and important thing to do. But I think that's what's kind of interesting, is that she's just absolutely unable to do that with her child. And so in a way, I wanted to have that juxtaposition. I wanted to see her doing that really brilliantly at work, and yet she's got her own blind spot in some ways. And of course, when we open up the story, he's already missing. And so in a way, it's a kind of double blind spot. Not only she has had the blind spot, you know, when he's been living with them, but now it's become its own trauma, hasn't it? Because of course he's missing. So she's got her own personal trauma in terms of grief and loss.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bev Thomas about her terrific debut novel, A Good Enough Mother. It was released by Viking Press on April 30th. You know, there was a very interesting part of this book. It's small, but it was very, I thought, very significant, perhaps because I faced a very similar situation when I was a therapist. Ruth has come into the action of this novel with already having had a problem in her job, because she was the last clinician to see a patient who had committed suicide. Has this ever happened to you?
No, I mean, in fact, none of the casework and none of the sort of detail is anything that I've drawn on in terms of my own personal life as a clinician. But these things do happen. And as you say, you may well have known people or teams who've been in that situation. In mental health, that is something that can happen. People do tragically take their own lives. And I guess one of the things that is to be explored really is what that leaves the clinician, therapist, doctor, psychiatrist, whoever it might be, with. Because in some ways, you know, you can't stop people doing certain things. You can't save everybody. But at the same time, in some ways, that's what they have kind of taken the job for. So I think it is really, it's such a conflict, and it's such a kind of a really difficult, it's a difficult thing.
Yes, it is. And as I said, I was the last person to see someone who was so determined, really, to take her own life, that she gave me all the right answers that she needed to for me to let her get released from a hospital stay. And then she went home and killed herself. She had a long history of manic depression, and life had become intolerable.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I was interested in exploring in the book is that, you know, in a way, there are no easy answers to parenting and motherhood, and nor are there any easy answers to psychological and mental health. I think it's a sort of myth to think that either of those are anything but complexities. So, you know, in some ways, both of them are themes that are really explored very in depth. Both themes are explored in real depth in this book. And I don't claim to have any easy answers to either of them. And I guess that was my intention in writing this, is wanting to just explore some of these themes, you know, and it, my sense already is that it's become a book that lots of people want to talk about at book clubs for precisely that reason. You know, what would you do? What do you think about that? What do you think about what she did? You know, I guess it's it's sort of the idea of provoking and promoting discussion about it, because it's certainly not my intention to, you know, I don't have the answers, you know, and I guess I hope by discussing these things, people will think about it and come up with their own decisions and thoughts about it, which is, you know, it's great if fiction can do that.
And it certainly does. This is just a terrific novel, The Good Enough Mother, and we're talking with the author, Bev Thomas. Now, I want to go back to Dan Griffin and Ruth. He is this patient. First of all, why does he arrive at this trauma practice?
So his kind of trigger in a way for coming is that he has had something that's happened to him in the park. He's been attacked in the park, and as a result of that, he is struggling. But what transpires is that in some ways the sort of incident in the present has triggered something much more complicated and deep-rooted that has gone on in his past. So in some ways, so his coming to see Ruth triggers a whole process for the reader, in that we also kind of are unraveling what's happened to Dan, what's going on with him. And, you know, in many ways, you know, while Ruth is sort of looking for a son when Dan comes in, I mean, what we then learn about Dan is that he's also looking for a mother. So it's a kind of perfect storm, both of them coming together.
And she lets Dan take control of the process of therapy in a way that is highly unusual for her, definitely outside the bounds of practice. Why does she do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are the, you know, and some of those issues start small, don't they, about, you know, how many sessions he offers and then him arriving late or early and these things. I mean, and then, but I guess what I wanted to show by that is that these are small, kind of very small transgressions that are showing the reader that she is losing control and he is gaining more control. So she does that. I mean, your question is, why does she do that? I mean, I think that's complicated. I think it's because she is unable to keep that firm boundary between Dan, the client, Tom, the son, and Ruth, the therapist, Ruth, the mother. So I think all of those four things start to blur a little bit. So where she might be able to, you know, easily step up with another client and be very clear about boundaries, right from the off, in a way, with Dan, there's a kind of pulling out of role. Is she his therapist? Does she want to be his mother? I think it's very blurred, really, from the outset. Really from that moment she looks up in the corridor and sees him, I think something shifts in her.
Yeah, and talk more about this, very much the sense of boundaries and how they are transgressed is at the heart of this novel. And I think a lot of people, let's say the lay public, don't really understand, you know, for example, why therapists can't be friends of their patients, or even, you know, these questions come up all the time, or why can't you give me advice about this, that, and the other thing? Yeah. Talk a little bit about the boundaries that therapists are trained to maintain.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, and I think, you know, one of the things that I was interested in exploring was really, really exploring it rather than sort of, you know, using the therapy as a sort of plot point. I really wanted the therapy to be the plot, as it were. And I think, you know, that the question, why can't, you know, therapist be your friend? You know, if you're going to get advice or you want to know whether you should do this or this, you know, most people have friends or colleagues or family members, they can ask that, and they can either choose to take that advice or not. I guess one of the things that the therapist is supposed to be able to do in that situation is to not be that person. So they are bounded to the extent that they, in an ideal world, you know very little about your therapist, and certainly the therapist doesn't come in chatting about their holidays or how many children they've got or what they like doing, because immediately then the client stops seeing them as a kind of blank slate that they could bring things into the session to. It kind of contaminates things in a way that's not helpful. So I think that one of the things that it's very helpful when there's sort of less information there is that the client can come in and the feelings that they have can be used. And that's, so I suppose that's what I was trying to explore in the book, is the sort of the notion of the transference and the counter transference, both of which are sort of tricky concepts, but in some ways I wanted to show them kind of at work in the room between Ruth and Dan, and Ruth and some of her other clients, really, so that, you know, there's another character who has lost a mother and she is bringing stuff into the room, really, about her feelings about her mother, and sort of projecting them onto Ruth so she can use them and help the person understand things differently. So it's very important that boundary is really kept. So I guess what I then did in the book was to get Ruth little by little to sort of transgress some of these boundaries, so that the reader understands that it might be small, but it's actually monumental that she's doing that.
And just very quickly, because we only have a few minutes left, tell our listeners what transference and countertransference are.
Yeah, so transference really is when, so for example, someone might come to therapy and they've had all sorts of different experiences of emotion to do with parents or parental figures or figures of authority, and that's sort of partly who they are. And in some ways, being able to go into the therapy room, you can project those feelings onto the person in front of you, and then the therapist can start to kind of help them understand what they might mean and where they come from. And countertransference is a feeling that therapist is full up with sometimes. And there's a few examples in the book where Ruth is absolutely flooded with a particular feeling that has come from the client in front of her. It's come from Dan. And partly what's very skilled for a therapist is to be able to use that feeling to kind of, you know, sometimes someone will be saying, no, I wasn't worried about that at all. I'm not anxious about that at all. But their body language and everything else about them projects extreme anxiety, but their voice is telling something different. And I guess a very skilled therapist will be able to try and, you know, put those two together instead of it being split off.
Oh, that's great. Now, just final question. This is your debut novel. Is there a second novel coming?
Yes, I have just started work on a new novel. So it's early days, but yeah, I'm really, it's been fantastic working and developing this one and seeing it sort of out in the world. I'm a good enough mother, but it's also really exciting to start writing something new.
Well, this has just been a terrific conversation, Bev Thomas. You are the author of a terrific novel, A Good Enough Mother. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Bev Thomas. You'll find an excerpt from A Good Enough Mother at, you guessed it, writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.